Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Do No Harm ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the app today.
What started out as a normal summer day for both the Bright family.
I put the sprinkler in the front yard. We were outside. Just playing in the water.
And the Butler family.
Typical 4th of July, just cooking some barbecue, having a good time with some other family members.
Turned into a nightmare.
I just heard it, all of a sudden, it was just this blood-curdling scream.
And I tried to catch him, and he kind of spun around and hit on his backside and fell back and hit his head on the floor.
Two moments. Two accidents, each thrusting these parents into a medical and legal maze that neither family ever imagined they would find themselves in.
Even at this point, it did not even dawn on me that they were accusing me of child abuse.
It don't matter. You were gonna demonize that man regardless because it was what they do.
What happens when the institutions we trust to keep kids safe?
Mom, baby, bed, one house, that's not an option. Right at this
point. Are what put them in danger.
I started losing confidence in the whole system. I didn't trust it. And again, my big question was why?
Over the last 6 episodes of this series, we've told you about a medical and legal system that's committed to a noble cause, protecting children from abuse. And what happens when that system goes too far?
By the time we got to court, the kids had been injured. But not by their parents, by the state.
In this episode, I'm going to be talking with Laura Beal, the host of Dr. Death, about what I've learned about the child welfare system over the past 2 years. Also, you'll remember in the previous episode, we told you that the two mothers at the center of this story had never met. Well, we have an update on that.
Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Sharday. How are you?
I'm doing all right. I'm doing good.
You're
How about yourself?
All right. Can't ask for much more this year, can we?
I don't think we can. Well, you know what? I look at it like this. We've been through something very, you know, similar. Very hard, very tough. So I think it makes us very strong.
Do you ever wonder where all your money went? Like every single time you look at your bank account? Honestly, it's probably all those subscriptions. I felt that way too, until I got Rocket Money. Rocket Money helped me see all the subscriptions I'm paying for, and it was eye-opening. Between streaming services, fitness apps, delivery services, it all adds up so quickly. Rocket Money is a personal finance app that finds and cancels your unwanted subscriptions, monitors your spending, and helps lower your bills. Rocket Money has over 5 million users and has helped save its members an average of $720 a year, with over 500 million in canceled subscriptions. Stop wasting money on things you don't use. Cancel your unwanted subscriptions by going to rocketmoney.com/Wondery. That's rocketmoney.com/Wondery. rocketmoney.com/Wondery.
Hey, I'm Ryan Reynolds. Recently, I asked Mint Mobile's legal team if big wireless companies are allowed to raise prices due to inflation. They said yes. And then when I asked if raising prices technically violates those onerous 2-year contracts, they said, what the f*** are you talking about, you insane Hollywood ass f-. So to recap, we're cutting the price of Mint Unlimited from $30 a month to just $15 a month. Give it a try at mintmobile.com/switch.
$45 up front for 3 months plus taxes and fees. Promo rate for new customers for limited time. Unlimited more than 40 gigabytes per month. Slows full terms at mintmobile.com.
My two hands alone can't hold you back from harm.
From NBC News and Wondery, I'm Mike Hixonball, and this is a special episode of Do No Harm. On Dr. Death, Laura Beal tells the stories of doctors who've strayed from their commitment to do no harm. In this series, we've told the stories of parents who rushed to hospitals with injured babies, only to discover that some of the doctors they thought were treating their children were actually working in tandem with law enforcement. Two very different stories, but they both deal with the trust we place in professionals and what happens when that trust is betrayed. And we're going to change things up a little bit today. Laura is going to be joining me, and she'll be the one asking the questions.
It's great to be here, Mike. I am so happy to have the opportunity to discuss this story. It really affected me profoundly, I have to say, as a mom. It affects anyone profoundly, but especially, like, just from the point of view of a mother thinking about this happening. It's been really haunting me for days and days, I have to say. So,
well, now you know how I felt for the last 2 years.
The whole story was just incredible. The first thing I have to ask you is, how are these children doing?
As far as they can tell, Dylan and Melissa don't see lingering trauma when they observe Mason and Charlotte. You know, you hear in the recording Mason's hoarse cry and Charlotte being disoriented after being in the care of strangers for 2 days and being injured in that time. But they're so small they don't remember it, and so they don't see it. It's tricky to know, though, because, you know, there's been a lot of research over the past, you know, several years, and it's come up as we've seen child separations at the border, where physicians say, you know, being an infant or a toddler being taken from their parent for even a couple days has lasting lifelong consequences. And so it's hard to know. It's one of those things that's really hard to know, but they're doing well. And same for the Butlers. Their children were similar age. They were gone for much longer, but they seem like they're adjusting well. Malia's into kindergarten. Charlotte's in preschool now. It seems like both families are happy and doing their best to move on.
Yeah, I mean, just the idea of being separated from your children, even normal separations when you have children are very difficult. The first time I took my oldest child, my little girl, to daycare, she was 9 months old. I stayed home for 9 months, and then I went back to work at the Dallas Morning News. And I remember I took her to daycare, and I sat in the parking lot and cried for a good 15 or 20 minutes, just sobbing at leaving her. And I was thinking about that when the Bright's children were taken away, and just that kind of anguish that I couldn't even begin to fathom. I mean, one of the things I was wondering about is how you came across this story in the first place.
So 2 years ago, I was an investigative reporter at the Houston Chronicle, and I remember this very clearly. My wife was actually had just gone into labor with our fourth child. And I remember it was early stages. She didn't have the baby for a couple more days. But I remember getting a text message from a fellow reporter at the Chronicle named Carrie Blakinger. And Carrie had been covering the Bright case in real time. And, you know, she had written a couple front page news stories about their court victory and kind of the mistakes made by CPS. And Carrie texted me to say, hey, do you want to investigate CPS with me? And I was like, sure, let's get in touch next month. I'm going to be on paternity leave here pretty soon. And so that was kind of the beginning. And, you know, just like you, from the very start of this, you know, I had never heard of, I'm going to reveal my privilege here. I'm a, you know, middle class, college educated white guy. And so the idea that CPS would take children from people without a good reason, who hadn't, you know, for sure abused their kids, was shocking to me. I know that's not shocking to a lot of people in the Black community who have been kind of living that reality for decades, but it was shocking to me from my lived experiences. And so, and then on the extra layer, I had never heard of the field of child abuse pediatrics. And so this idea that there are specialized doctors at children's hospitals who are looking behind, you know, in medical records in patients who come into the ER to see if, you know, very small children's injuries match parents' stories. And you know, with the goal of trying to protect them from abuse. But I had never heard of any of that. And so, you know, as a reporter, I'm like, we're going to do that. And so Carrie and I spent better part of a year investigating this and writing about a lot more than just the Bright family, investigating the system and the way it works and the way it doesn't work.
And how did you find the other families?
So, the written series, Do No Harm, that we wrote in collaboration between the Houston Chronicle and NBC News, we spotlighted several families. And in the end, we talked with, you know, close to 70 families who shared similar experiences, mostly in Texas, but also in states across the country. And initially, it was just, you know, CPS is tough. Just like in healthcare, there are privacy rules. And so I can't just go down to the courthouse and ask for a listing of every court case in which a child abuse pediatrician testified. And so it was a lot of networking and calling lawyers and searching the appeals court cases that do become public. And I spent months talking to 50 Melissa Brights and Dylan Brights. From across Texas, mostly initially. And it was kind of, you know, you could be kind of begin to find a pattern in some of these cases where you see where the system kind of breaks down. But one thing we could never do is quantify it. People ask me, how widespread is this? Is this happening every day? And it's impossible to say, because this is kind of one of these intractable systems where you can't just ask the government and get public records requests to find every case. So it's really challenging reporting.
It was just so incredible. Well, I actually read your initial series on this case. So I knew, I had a general sense before I started the podcast of what was going to happen. But I have to say, it was so hard, especially that third episode I listened. I was actually out for a run, and when I heard the tape of Melissa, I honestly I thought I was going to have to stop and throw up. I mean, just the audio, even knowing what was happening, the audio was just so deeply, deeply disturbing. I'm just wondering what's been the reaction from other people.
I think a lot of people have had that same reaction. I've had multiple messages from people who said, I felt nauseous listening to that, a lot of them being parents. And, you know, that's, it's hard. It's hard to know that this is traumatizing just to hear that tape. I will say, the first time I heard it, I was blown away. And I really think that when I heard that audio, it kind of crystallized to me why this story was important. Because I think, like, nobody thinks that we shouldn't have CPS, or that the state shouldn't step in when small, vulnerable children are at risk of being abused, or when there's clear signs of a pattern of abuse or serious neglect, not just, you know, poverty-related issues. But I think the risk is that we end up thinking, well, I mean, if you can prevent one child from being killed, then you should just be better safe than sorry, better to take a kid and then give them back later. And when you hear that tape, it's impossible to hear that and think, yeah, that's good policy. There's this immediate visceral reaction to the sound of a mother having her children taken from her, and the children confused. And you hear later in the series kind of the trauma that they experienced. They can't even articulate it. And so it kind of forces the conversation now. Like, okay, yes, we should protect children, but how do we find the balance so that we're not needlessly traumatizing kids in the process?
I mean, you know, the story itself is just shocking in and of itself. But was there anything in particular that surprised you while you were working on it?
Like I said, I think the whole thing surprised me from the start. I've done investigative reporting focused on physicians and healthcare and hospitals, but social services and CPS and child welfare was new. And I think, like a lot of people, I just made assumptions about what CPS does. And so I think the thing that was most stunning to me as I looked through each of these cases, not just the Brights, but also the Butlers and dozens of others, was the deference that the Child Welfare Agency, the CPS investigators, gave to the child abuse pediatricians. And you can understand why they do that. I mean, when you're a social worker and, you know, maybe you have an associate's degree or bachelor's degree in social work and you're not a doctor, you haven't gone to, you know, the child abuse pediatrician not just completed medical school, they also did a 3-year fellowship in identifying signs of injuries. And so when they file a report, it's supposed to be the beginning of CPS's investigation. Okay, the doctor says these injuries are concerning for abuse or consistent with abuse. When a CPS worker gets a report like that, just saying these injuries are concerning for abuse, they take that, and what I see in case after case after case, they often treat that as, instead of the start of the investigation, it is the investigation. And you hear it in the tape. And when CPS comes to take the kids and Melissa's saying, why? But we had the second opinion. The radiologist said, you know, she pointed to actual research papers that shows you can get 2 skull fractures from a short fall. And so Melissa's story did potentially match. But when they raise that question with the CPS worker, what's the response? Well, we still have what we have from Texas Children's Hospital. And you see that in case after case where the Child Welfare Agency has ceded authority to physicians who have no, you know, authority to remove kids. And so, and then when you ask the doctors about that, they point back and say, well, it's CPS's job to do the investigation. And so that, I think that's where the heart of the problem is.
Yeah, that's one thing that was shocking. You know, don't the people who work at CPS, like, are they just automatons sometimes? Because can you not see, yes, you have this doctor's report, but does that mean you can't see this baby who is hurting himself, crying for his mom all night? Does that not factor in? Does it not factor in that you have a conflicting opinion? I mean, all of these, when all the other evidence around you is telling you that these are caring parents, it's just the sort of robotic nature of them doing their job was just so surprising to me. The Butlers as well. I mean, there was, other than this one report, there was no evidence that these parents abused their kids. In fact, there was a lot of evidence to the contrary. And does that not, do you stop thinking once you get that report?
I think that's the risk. I think that's what happens in many cases is, you know, I think Dan Fee Nguyen, who is the county attorney whose job was to defend CPS's case, to argue CPS's case in the Bright case. And his, you know, you hear in the story that he had doubts about CPS's work on it. And his big criticism of CPS is like, you have well-intentioned people who are just at some point acting like a robot, like you said. And one thing I should mention is that, you know, throughout this series, we did reach out to CPS and to LeVar and to Naisha to request interviews, but they declined. And so the CPS has policies and protocols, and, you know, particularly in Texas, but also places in other places across the country, the child abuse pediatricians are often, as in Texas, grant funded by the state child welfare agency, same in other states. And in those contracts, the child abuse pediatricians are the medical authority for CPS. And I think there are times when CPS caseworkers who are more experienced maybe push back, but it's tough.
The best way to learn a language? Immersion. Living where the language is spoken and using it every day. But if that's not in the cards this year, you can still learn a language the second best way, and that's with Babbel. Babbel's quick 10-minute lessons are designed by over 200 language experts to help you start speaking a new language in as little as 3 weeks. Don't waste time on apps that don't work. Babbel's conversation-based teaching prepares you for real-life situations. And studies from Yale, Michigan State University, and others continue to prove Babbel is better. One study found that using Babbel for 15 hours is equivalent to a full semester at college. Here's a special limited-time deal for our listeners. Right now, get up to 60% off your Babbel subscription, but only for our listeners, at babbel.com/truecrime. Get up to 60% off at babbel.com/truecrime, spelled B-A-B-B-E-L.com/truecrime. Rules and restrictions may apply.
This episode is brought to you by Shopify. Whether you're selling t-shirts from a booth at your local farmer's market or dishing out handmade crafts online, Shopify's POS system manages it all. Unite your in-person and online business with a trusted platform that supports your retail hustle. Get started with hardware tailored to your needs, from payments on the go to full-scale retail setups, with round-the-clock support to keep your sales smooth as silk. Do the smart thing for retail. Go with Shopify. For a limited time, sign up for a $1 per month trial period at shopify.com/wondery, all lowercase. Take your business to new heights. Visit shopify.com/wondery today. That's shopify.com/wondery.
While I was listening to this podcast, I kept thinking back to something that happened when my daughter was 2 years old, same age as Charlotte. My husband had gotten into a habit of swinging her by her hands, and which she loved. It was her favorite thing to do. And as she got bigger, she kept saying, "Higher, Daddy, higher." I guess it's a dad thing to like swing your kids. And so one day he was in the kitchen. She was about two, and he's got her little hands, and he would swing her by the hands. And then at the top of the arc of the swing, he would let go of her briefly and grab her hands again. And that just thrilled her. She loved it. And she would laugh and squeal, and he'd swing her again and let go and grab her. And one day he was doing that in the kitchen, and she wiggled a little at the top of the swing, and he missed her hands. And she went flat onto the kitchen floor, face down. And that sound of your child hitting a concrete floor is something I will never forget as long as I live. And she landed face down. And of course, we rush over, and she's bloody because she landed on her nose and her face. And she didn't break anything, didn't look like. And after a while, she was fine. And the next day was a Sunday, so we go to church, and her face is all bruised up, and she's got a black eye, and her nose is swollen. She looks terrible. She feels fine, but she looks terrible. And of course, everybody's like, "Well, what happened? What happened?" And she would say, "Oh, Daddy did it," and just laugh, and we would laugh. But I was thinking about that incident listening to this podcast. I mean, what if she would have fallen on the back of her head? Because probably landing on her nose is what kept her from breaking any bones. And if that would have happened and we would have gone to the hospital, like, what could have happened to us?
I think pretty much every parent has a story like that. And I think one important thing to point out is, like you and like me, the stories I shared, the vast majority of parents who have scares like that, who accidentally hurt their kids, they don't lose them. They take them to the hospital if they need medical care. And, you know, maybe the doctors take a look, maybe CPS gets referred, maybe not. But in the vast majority of, you know, incidents where babies fall a short distance and hit their head, they don't even need medical care. And so when they show up at the hospital, those are the kind of extreme outliers already. And I think it's probably accurate that in most cases, child abuse pediatricians take a look and they say, "Yeah, that matches the story," and the kids go home. The challenge is when you get to this subset of cases where, like Mason Bright, you know, you don't expect two skull fractures and subdural bleeding from a short fall. But then you have to, you know, there's other factors that come into play. He fell onto concrete and he had a bleeding disorder. And, well, you can get two skull fractures from a short fall. And it's been documented in the medical research. It happens maybe in less than 10% of cases of that height. But we don't know in what percentage of cases does that happen when they fall on concrete, for example. Like, it might be higher. I also completely understand why we have child abuse pediatricians, why that subspecialty exists. I think, you know, there's some conversations that maybe could be had about the interplay between child abuse pediatricians and CPS. giving CPS autonomy to, you know, speak with additional doctors, other subspecialists, and making sure that the reports from child abuse pediatricians have the appropriate level of nuance. And so I have seen reports in cases where they say these injuries are diagnostic of abuse. You know, you cover healthcare, that means this is it. These injuries can only be abuse. And that's almost never the case. You can almost never just declare these are abuse and not an accident. And so there should be a conversation, I think, and there's one happening now, I think, in medicine about how can we appropriately report our concern to make sure CPS catches it, you know, looks at this, takes a hard look at it, but without tying their hands and forcing removals when it's not appropriate.
It makes you wonder what these stories say broadly about child protective services. And it's horrible when they take kids away unnecessarily, but they also get it on both sides. I mean, when they leave kids in dangerous situations, you know, I'm from Dallas. I remember the Sharon Matthews case, you know, and the terrible things that happened to that child. And I think they do protect children, and they are very important, and they have a very important job.
You know, I think you're right. CPS has been handed an impossible task. And so I think that is the kind of the big challenge is child abuse is so horrific that we have put a system in place that seeks to catch it before it gets out of hand, before a child is seriously injured, traumatized, or killed. It's impossible. You can never prevent every one of these incidents. I actually think one of the main areas of reform is not in the government, but it's in media and in journalism. And I will say, in working on this series, I've come to discover that there's a certain genre of investigative journalism that is kind, in some ways, low-hanging fruit for reporters. And you see it in state after state. A child was reported to CPS. CPS began investigation. The child later died. And Sharon Matthews' case is an example of that. It's horrific. And as a result of the intense media attention and the finger pointing at CPS of, you know, for failing in those cases, triggers a reaction. There was just a report out of Florida by a team of investigative reporters there at USA Today and Gatehouse that showed after the Miami Herald did an investigation showing children dying in the care of CPS or after being reported to CPS, in the aftermath of that, the state instituted this very aggressive, I'll say, better safe than sorry approach where we're going to do whatever it takes to protect children. And they vastly expanded the number of removals, mostly cases of neglect or suspicion of neglect. And they overburdened the foster care system to the point that now children in the most recent years have been being sent to unsafe foster homes. And so you can see the media's role in triggering that unintended consequence. And so, you know, finding a way to be more nuanced in our reporting of these stories as well. CPS is never going to stop every child death.
And CPS also gets their share of conspiracy theories, don't they?
That's right. I'm glad you bring that up because, you know, there's actually in the current world we live in, you know, and I've heard from a lot of these people, actually, there's a current, you know, offshoot of the QAnon conspiracy that says, you know, CPS agencies are actually trafficking children. It is complete nonsense. There's no evidence that's the case. These agencies make mistakes. There are bad actors in them for sure, but it's just a patchwork of state agencies. There's no global conspiracy to strip children from their parents and to sell them. And so, you know, I've heard from these people, and I think, you know, if you have been led to believe that's the case, that CPS is part of a child trafficking network, I would advise that you would rethink where you get some of your information.
I wondered throughout this series about LeVar, and I would love to have known what he was thinking. And you tried to get hold of him, and in episode 6, we learn he is actually still working for CPS. What can you tell us about LeVar?
The thing I want you to know about LeVar is what Melissa told me. After I reached out to LeVar and spoke with him just very briefly, I was struck by his politeness and kindness to me. Like, I'd written a story already about this case. He was named in it. We played the recording. And this case has been, I'm sure, a huge headache for him in the aftermath. And he just was so kind. He thanked me for the work that journalists do and thanked me for reaching out. I was so taken aback by, I don't get that a lot. You know, you call people and they're the subject of a story. It's, you know, often yelling and
oh, yeah.
Yes, right. You've done this. So I called Melissa afterward and was like, you know, this guy was so kind and respectful. And that's when she revealed to me that, and it's something we weren't able to put in the series, but after their case was over and completely settled, Melissa says LeVar approached her in court and told her that he was sorry about the way their case had turned out. And I mean, this is not something that I was able to confirm with LeVar, but according to Melissa, it was a very touching moment for her. And she told me she has no ill feelings about him. And she knows that he's got a good heart. And for that reason, she's glad he still works in Child Protective Services. But that was kind of a heartwarming, faith-restoring detail that I learned is, you know, this is a system. This story was not about villainous CPS workers. It was about a system that means well and sometimes does harm.
So in this podcast, we see the twin trajectories of Dylan and Melissa Bright and Lance and Sharday Butler. And in episode 6, you state that Black babies brought to the ER are twice as likely as white babies to be evaluated for abuse. What are the consequences of that?
The doctors and nurses and social workers are people, and they have their own range of experiences and their own range of implicit bias. And when a Black baby comes into the ER, just as you said, if they have subdural bleeding, which is bleeding around their brain, this is the study that I cited there showed that they are twice as likely to be evaluated for abuse. And if you're evaluated for abuse, then that is the beginning of the path toward maybe a CPS referral. And so that's just one data point. I mean, the most shocking data point that I came across in all of this reporting was that if you're a Black child in America, by the time you turn 18, there is a 50% chance that you have been the subject of a CPS investigation. It's a coin flip. And so the Butlers, in some ways, you know, the circumstances are different. And often these cases involve allegations of neglect that are often tied to poverty issues or addiction. The Butler's case is somewhat different, but in some ways, by virtue of that statistic, their experience with CPS was almost more likely than not. And so that was so eye-opening. And it's why we told the story in the way we did. We told the story of the Brights, and we mentioned nothing about race throughout the entirety of their story. And people can detect that. But we take you and make you feel and show you what it sounds like when a baby's taken. And then we pivot and we tell you the story of how this played out for this Black family who had a child with very similar injuries. And there's lots of differences in their cases, but you can see in the way that their case was handled that there are just differences. And the Butlers and their lawyer and a lot of people who've heard this story can, you know, feel that race is a factor in it.
So, you keep trying to get in shape and it keeps not working. I'm Lacey Green, a super trainer with Body. That's BODI.com. And I've got a story you have to hear. I have a client who came to me because she was really frustrated that every gym or trainer she tried made her feel bad because she was a beginner. She had tried it all and she just felt humiliated. And that's when we started working together and I took her through my 3-week program called For Beginners Only. Once she realized that she wasn't the problem and that she just needed the right program, she started to get results. And now she's completely unstoppable and feeling so strong and confident. And I can do the same for you. On the Body app, subscribers lose 5 to 10 pounds consistently in their first month. And I bet you will too. In fact, CNN underscore just named Body best fitness app. And right now, Body has a special introductory offer. The next 500 new users who sign up for a year of Body save 72%. That's just 33 cents a day. All you have to do is go to body.com. That's BODI.com.
Thank you.
So what kind of reaction have you gotten both from the initial stories that you did on this a year ago and the podcast from CPS and lawmakers and child abuse pediatricians? I would imagine they had some pretty strong feelings.
Yeah, I think there's a whole range of responses to that. CPS and the lawmaker side in Texas, they're looking at potential reforms in this legislative session to try to improve the process to make sure we can protect kids like Sharon Matthews, who really were being abused, while also protecting the rights of parents like the Brights and the Butlers, who weren't. And so it's tricky, and there's efforts to reform that. I've gotten pretty good reaction from lawmakers and from, you know, even some CPS officials kind of on background that, like, these are important things and we're glad you raised them. I will say, you know, it's been more contentious, I think, in terms of reaction from the child abuse pediatric community. And I've tried to frame these stories as like, look, this is important work that's being done, and they play an important role in saving children's lives. But I will say, having covered healthcare for many years, when I would write a story about a heart surgeon who was chronically making mistakes and harming patients, and I would talk to other heart surgeons about that, you know, the reaction from those other heart surgeons, they would say, yeah, that's a problem. They could do it better. That's outside the standard of care. In this case, when we've highlighted legitimate, real problems with individual cases of reports from child abuse pediatricians, cases where they overstate the evidence, misstate the evidence, fail to report a bleeding disorder, that's key, use hyperbole, like saying a child was looks like they were thrown from a second-story building, a phrase that has no basis in science. When I've highlighted these things, I would expect, you know, a similar kind of response. You know what? Thanks for pointing that out. That's outside the standard of care. We really shouldn't be. We should be more nuanced in our phrasing. I've gotten none of that. The child abuse pediatricians that I've heard from, it's a small, close-knit group of physicians, and they've been very critical of the reporting. I want to make clear, is nobody disputes that the doctors and the social workers should have contacted CPS in both the Bright and the Butler case. I think, you know, when a child comes into the hospital and they have serious injuries, it makes sense, you know, do the investigation. Our series was really focused on investigating what went wrong after that point. And so, you know, there's been, I think, some criticism I see out there that, you know, telling these kinds of stories will make people hesitant to report, or somehow that we're arguing that doctors shouldn't notify CPS about concerning injuries. I don't think anyone makes that case. I know the Brights don't, the Butlers don't, their lawyers don't. Dr. Julie Mack doesn't say that. It's really, you know, we should have a high, you know, alert and report to CPS when physicians see something that's concerning. But it's what CPS does with that information and how they investigate after where the system, you know, started to break down in these cases.
What about parents, other parents?
Oh, my God. It's impossible to quantify how often this happens. And it's still the case because there's no way of just kind of getting a public record. But I can tell you, I have heard now from, I haven't tabulated it, but it's certainly more than 600 families from across the country. You know, I can't tell you how many messages I get, even still, especially now that the podcast is out, from parents saying, I dropped my baby today or yesterday, and I'm at the ER now, and CPS is involved. What do I do? And it's really hard. I can tell you that I've responded to many of these families, and I've reviewed close to 100 of their cases, and find a similar pattern in many of them. But I've reached a point where we can no longer respond to everybody. It's hard to know, impossible to know in a lot of cases. So, but there's the response has been overwhelming, and it's picking up since the podcast is out.
Have Melissa and Chardet, have they also heard from people?
Yeah, well, I mean, Melissa did for sure. Melissa, because their story was published before, you know, she heard from dozens or hundreds of families who have been in similar situations. And Sade hadn't, because we hadn't written her story before the podcast. But recently, since the podcast has come out, they have had a chance to get in touch. We actually recorded the moment when they talked for the first time. It was very touching.
Hi, Melissa.
Hi, Sade. How are you?
I'm doing all right. One thing you said in your in the podcast, you said that, you know, you felt like if you guys were honest about everything and how you kind of like almost complimenting CPS, you know, you guys are just doing your jobs and I'm going to do everything I have to do to cooperate. I mean, same thing here. I mean, I remember saying all those things to them. So it felt good to know, like, you know, other people think like me, would have did the same thing as I've done, you know? So I felt good about that. I did.
You're right. But, you know, I felt like I was thanking them while they were taking my kids, and looking back, I'm like, what was I doing? Because you don't know.
Exactly. I felt the same way. I did the same thing. I did the same exact thing. But when you look back, yeah, you're like, what was I doing? What was I thinking? You know, I guess just trying to be sane in all of it, really, you know, just trying to keep balance. I remember when Stephanie told us, you know, she didn't give us details. She just told us to watch the news. And I'm going to be honest with you. I didn't really pay much attention, because at the time, I didn't want to hear about nobody else's kids getting taken away. At the time, everything that was going on at the borders with the children was going on. And I couldn't bear it anymore. And I remember Lance telling me about the conversation he had with Stephanie. And then I do remember somewhat of the news, what, you know, you guys being on the news. And then I remember my mom telling me about it, because she watched it and she recorded it on her phone. And so I was like, well, maybe this is, you know, what Stephanie's talking about. So I just think, like, man, if that did not happen, it's like somebody else's misery, I guess, like, and what you guys went through. I mean, if that didn't happen, I probably would not have my kids right now.
I was trying to hold it in, but you were making me cry. I just feel like, you know, the kids are so precious, and you don't ever know how you're going to make it through on the other end, because I have, you know, a whole bunch of different milestones in my own journey that if this person didn't step up, or if that person didn't show up, and so on and so forth, I wouldn't have my kids back either. And so just to know how it's all intertwined together is, it's really refreshing. So I'm glad that you are whole and your family is back together and that you get to touch your kids in.
Oh, every night I'm so blessed. And when I see you with your family and everything, and I look at me and my family, it's like, you would never know. Nobody walking down the street would know what we've been through, you know, because we still walk around and we still smile and we're still happy, and we don't have anger on our sleeves. Like, we're not, you know, we're upset and we're hurt. I know I'm hurt. I feel like a lot of my trust has been broken, but I still walk around, I still treat people good, and I'm just trying to be happy and raise my kids. So I see that in your family as well. You know, we're not angry with the world. We're angry about our situation, but we're not angry with the world about what happened to us. So, you know, I mean, I thank you. I just feel like you guys were just really, you guys were really y'all fought. You know, y'all seem like y'all really, really fought. And sometimes I just didn't have the strength to fight as hard as I wanted to. You know, I thank you for your story and you guys coming out there in the public eye. Because if it wasn't for your case, like I said, I don't know what I would have done. I don't know where my kids would be right now. So I thank you guys. I really do. I really, really do.
Sharda, you do not give yourself enough credit, girl. You fought the long, you ran a marathon.
You fought every single day that they were not in your home. And I don't, if I had to run a marathon and not like this, you know, little 5K, I don't know if I would have survived it. So you need to give yourself more credit, because that it's not easy for the duration that I endured. And I think yours was like, what, 3 or 4 times as long as our battle. It was like, what, 18 or 19 months? Am I right?
It was, yeah. It was almost 2 years.
Well, Sharday, there's a group of us sisters. We never wanted to be sisters by this way, but the next time we all get together, I want you to come and you can hear some other warrior moms and they can hear you and meet you. And I think it'd be really fun. It'd be really fun to just see and hug you in person. I know with COVID and everything going on, it might be a little while, but when the time comes and we're able to, but until then, I know we'll text.
Yeah, we will. And definitely, like, just let me know and I'll be there. I would love to meet, you know, other people, you know, who's been in the same situation and share our stories.
It was really special for me to be on the line hearing the two of them connect for the first time. You know, I'd spent months reporting on this story, knowing that their two stories were linked, but that they didn't know each other at all. And they have this shared bond of trauma. And it just was so touching to hear them discuss it and then talk about making plans to stay in touch.
So you've been living and breathing this story for, what, 2 years now? I mean, what kind of impact has this story had just on you moving forward?
In a, you know, there's a certain inherited or shared trauma that you get just from hearing these stories. And I think one thing is, it's not, you know, it had the effect of turning me into a bit of a helicopter parent. right before we came in here to record this, my almost 2-year-old was running out the door and my dog ran out at the same time and sideswiped him and cut his feet out from under him. And he hit his head on the sidewalk right before I walked in here. And, you know, it was like you hear that little thunk and, you know, it's, you know, it's my 4th kid. At this stage, I know that that type of fall is not typically a big deal. So I picked him up and I patted him and immediately went to my wife and told her every detail of what just happened. And I feel like I am hypervigilant now. And if you go to the hospital and that incident has happened and they say, hey, they've got 2 fractures, okay. You know, that's when you start to think about, okay, documentation, document, document, document. There are a lot of kids who, families who have gone through this, you know, and not gotten their kids back. Lives have been destroyed, and it's hard to take all that in and think about it. It's a good reminder just to love on my kids and to spend good time with them and to not, you know, spend too much time worrying because you don't know what tomorrow holds.
That sounds like a great note to end on.
I really appreciate this, Laura. I've enjoyed talking with you. From NBC News and Wondery, this is a special episode of Do No Harm, a story about innocent children and the adults who are supposed to keep them safe. Do No Harm was written, reported, and hosted by me, Mike Hixenbaugh, a national investigative reporter for NBC News. Special thanks to my reporting partner, Carrie Blakinger, whose reporting made this podcast possible. If you want to help us spread the word, please give us a 5-star rating and review on Apple Podcasts, and be sure to tell your friends. Subscribe on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, the Wondery app, or wherever you're listening right now. In the episode notes, you'll find some links and offers from our sponsors. Please support them. Another way you can support the show is by filling out a small survey at wondery.com/survey. If you have a tip about a story you think we should investigate, email us at tips@wondery.com. That's tips@wondery.com. Associate producers are Chris Siegel and Allison Bailey. Story editor is Julie Shapiro. Additional production assistance from Daniel Gonzalez. Managing producer, Leta Pandya. Sound design by Jay Rothman. executive produced for NBC News by Steve Lickteig. Executive produced by George Lavender, Marshall Louis, and Hernan Lopez for Wondery.
Hey, Prime members, you can listen to Do No Harm ad-free on Amazon Music. Download the Amazon Music app today. Or you can listen ad-free with Wondery Plus and Apple Podcasts. Before you go, tell us about yourself by completing a short survey at wondery.com/survey.
Whether you're working out, walking, or running errands, Audible can help you keep your heart rate up month after month with their pulse-pounding collection of thrilling audiobooks that you can't hear anywhere else. As an Audible member, you can choose one title a month to keep from their entire catalog, which includes thousands of titles. This month, check out the Audible original, The Space Within. It's a chilling 8-part story about a psychiatrist, Dr. Maddie Weil, voiced by Academy Award winner Jessica Chastain, who is tasked with unlocking the memories of a child who went missing for 7 hours. Maddie soon discovers that there are more who have faced similar experiences, and the truth of what is happening to them may impact the fate of humankind. New members can try Audible free for 30 days. Visit audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500. That's audible.com/thrill or text thrill to 500-500.
In the climate-ravaged year of 2072, the city of Pura stands as a miraculous green haven, a geoengineered paradise that protects fortunate residents from the global catastrophes of heat domes, fires, floods, and droughts. Demetria Lopez heads up Pura's public relations, tirelessly promoting the city's idyllic image. But when she stumbles upon a dark secret that, if exposed, would be the downfall of Pura's existence, she must decide who and what she is willing to protect. From Wondery, the makers of Academy and Dr. Death, The Last City stars actors Reyes Seahorn, Jeannie Tirado, and Maury Sterling. Follow The Last City on the Wondery app or wherever you get your podcasts. You can binge all episodes of The Last City early and ad-free right now by joining Wondery Plus.